Day 18 of the Russia-Ukraine conflict, Russian forces have advanced closer to the capital Kiev from the north, west, and northeast and destroyed airports in the town of Vasilki. German Chancellor and the French President have called for an immediate ceasefire in Ukraine during phone calls with the Russian President Vladimir Putin. And multiple rockets target a base hosting American troops and two Israeli Mossad training centers in the northern Iraqi city of Erbil. Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on Blue World News. It's now 18th day of Russia's offensive on Ukraine. Air raid sirens and shelling have been ringing out throughout the beleaguered country as Russian forces are gaining ground around the capital, Kiev. Russian forces have advanced even closer to the capital from the north, west, and northeast. Russian strikes have also destroyed an airport in the town of Vasilkiv, south of the capital. Elsewhere in Ukraine, the besieged northern city of Chernihiv has come under intense shelling. New artillery and air attacks have also been reported in several other cities. In the south, the port city of Mykolaiv is also under heavy bombardment. Ukrainian officials say a mosque has been shelled in the besieged city of Mariupol. Kiev has for the first time given a toll to the country's forces.
People are being killed. We're not happy that we have lost some 1,300 soldiers and Russia has lost about 12,000, 1 to 10. It doesn't give me joy that they have lost 12,000. It doesn't make me happy. This, because of this, you know, this is not the way I see the world.
Ukrainian officials say the country is facing a humanitarian crisis and needs food as well as medicine. They also said that heavy shelling and threats of Russian air attacks are endangering attempted evacuations of civilians from encircled towns and cities. So far, nearly 2.6 million people, most of them women and children, have fled Ukraine for neighboring countries. As the offensive intensifies in Ukraine, one story has been discovered by our correspondent in Poland. Robert Carter has met a Russian living in Poland who is helping a Ukrainian family who fled the war.
As the vicious war in Ukraine rages on, refugees struggle to find somewhere, anywhere, safe to stay. The dominant media narratives are heavily focused on Russians and Ukrainians fighting each other. But here in Poland, Press TV found a unique exception. Meet Svetlana, a Ukrainian mother who fled Kyiv with her two children, Dmytro and Ksenia. They have been taken in by a native Russian who lives in Lublin with his Polish wife.
For me, it wasn't even choice. I just started to write to my friends in the messengers and suggest them help or hosting. And I think it's the only choice I had. I feel angry that I can't stop it, I can't help.
Svetlana was forced to flee as the fighting surrounded the city. Her family have endured a 630-kilometer journey through the freezing cold. She tells us the ordeal has been traumatizing.
After the war started, it was a great fear that hit us. The first thing I did was turn on the news. Then I collected just three suitcases and suddenly we had to run. We didn't know what to pack, what to eat, what medicine to bring, how will we cook, and what about school. To be honest, to be less stressed, I just turned off my feelings. If I had time to think about all the danger, I'd probably go crazy. The journey we had to deal with and the uncertainty. It was physically very hard, and I was only allowed to relax and cry once we escaped.
Poland has become a beacon of sanctuary for many refugees, with some 1.5 million already entered the country and many more on the way.
Unfortunately, the refugee crisis has now become heavily politicized, specifically in the English-speaking world. But behind those headlines are just ordinary people trying to get by. Regardless of whether they speak Russian, Ukrainian or Polish, the civilians all ultimately want the same thing, regardless of where they come from. An end to the war. Robert Carter, Lublin.
France and Germany have renewed calls on Russia for a ceasefire in Ukraine and a diplomatic solution to this conflict. In a conference phone call, the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz and French President Emmanuel Macron called on the Russian President Vladimir Putin to lift a days-long siege of the Ukrainian city of Mariupol. Macron referred to allegations of rights abuses by Russian soldiers, warning that they may amount to war crimes. Over the past days, diplomatic efforts by world leaders to end this conflict have made no progress. Kiev says it remains open to diplomacy, but will not give in to ultimatums.
Of course, this doesn't exclude the track of diplomacy and the need to talk and to find solutions. But as President Zelensky said on a number of occasions, we are ready to negotiate, but we are not going to accept any ultimatums and surrender.
The Ukrainian foreign minister added that if his country had more fighter jets, it would have been able to save more civilian lives by targeting Russian military convoys. He explained the main striking force of Russia is in the air. The U.S. President Joe Biden has authorized an additional $200 million worth of weaponry and assistance to Ukraine. This is while Russia has warned that Western supplies of weapons to the country are legitimate targets for its troops. Now joining us for shed more light on the Ukrainian conflict is Lawrence Davison, former lecturer out of Westchester University, Westchester, Pennsylvania. Professor Lawrence Davison, always a pleasure to check in with you, sir. Okay, day 18, your thoughts on where we stand so far, efforts to try to get some ceasefire going and some more diplomacy involved, and the refugee influx. Estimated, Larry, up to 4 million refugees. We're around 2 point something right now, but 4 million refugees in total are about to flee Ukraine in total in the few days to come.
Yeah, and that doesn't even account for the fact that the Russians haven't pushed really into Western Ukraine yet. If they do, that will ratchet up the refugee numbers. I think that the Russians are following their own timeline here. I'm skeptical of reports that say the Ukrainians, are slowing them down and holding them up. I'm sure there's intense fighting and all, but I think that the Russians are playing to their own timeline. They have particular targets. I'm sure they want to take Kiev, and I think they want to take Mariupol. Is that the name of the city in the east? Because it's the headquarters of a sort of Nazi army division of the Ukrainian army. I don't see any immediate prospect of a diplomatic settlement, and that's a real shame. I mean, Zelensky, the president in Kiev, seems to, in my opinion, seems to have a real martyr complex. I mean, he's going to go down with the ship, and he's sort of making sure that the ship does go down.
All right, Larry, always a pleasure to check in with you. Stay safe, pal. Joining us, Lawrence Davison, their former lecturer from Westchester, Pennsylvania. And now, Iraqi media says a number of explosions have been heard in the city of Erbil in the country's region of Kurdistan. The media cited local officials saying multiple rockets have hit U.S. military bases in the area. There are also reports suggesting that Washington's new consulate building and two advanced Israeli Mossad training centers in Erbil have come under rocket attacks. Now, security forces are on high alert, and roads to Erbil Airport have been closed. Alarm sirens have also been activated in the U.S. Embassy inside the highly secured green zone of the Iraqi capital, Baghdad. U.S. officials say there have been no casualties. Attacks are the latest in a series of such strikes targeting U.S. interests in Iraq. Joining us now from Toronto, Canada, is Eric Wahlberg, author and journalist, for more on the story. Hello, Eric. Hope you're safe and doing well. These attacks, whether it's U.S. Military convoys on the roads, bases, frequent attacks over the last couple of years. Why do you think it's the case, Eric? Eric Wahlberg, can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay, good. I was putting my first question to you. We're talking about Iraq, obviously. U.S. interests have been suffering quite a bit of attacks on Iraqi soil over the last couple of years. What are your thoughts on why and the ramifications of these attacks?
Well, I don't even know if there's been any clear evidence of who does most of the attacks. So I haven't any real I can't say that point fingers at anyone, but I mean, it's a boiling kettle, and it's going to have flashes of boiling over, and it's a bit chaotic. The whole Middle East is becoming more and more chaotic. And if this is true, that this base that in Erbil was is an Israeli-sponsored training center, that would be quite a big earthquake. I really don't know what the ramifications. I have to think about it. It's certainly not good for the U.S. I can say that. I don't know if it's good for anybody. But.
I mean, Eric, but you know, Iraq is kind of it's a special case. When you look at the Middle East, there's a lot going on in Syria and Afghanistan. Stories and narratives are completely different. When it comes to Iraq, there was a fake pretext. You remember weapons of mass destruction. Saddam Hussein is a dictator. We have to get him out of office. They go in there. They hang the guy. In 2 weeks, Saddam is gone. But the U.S. stayed there for nearly 20 years. They brought it so much instability into the country that Daesh terrorist group emerged. And then after they killed Iran's top military commander, Sayyidullah Soleimani, you very well know, Iraqi parliament voted for U.S. forces to leave. And they said they will, but they're still there. Why?
Well, and there are, I think it's 50 bases actually in Iraq, scattered where strategically. And so it's not a huge force. I don't know if it's 3,000 troops or 5,000, I can't remember, but they don't seem to be going anywhere. That Iraqi parliament tried, and it was just brushed aside. So we know who is really controlling still what's going on in Iraq, but it's getting out of control. And if this Israeli connection comes out, that will really that's a spark that will really ignite the anti-Israeli sentiment. It's going to just galvanize.
All right, Paul, stay safe, and thanks for joining us from Toronto, Canada. That was Eric Wahlberg there joining us. And now Oil Minister Javad Oji says that Iran has managed to defeat a U.S. campaign to push a country's oil income to zero. The minister says Iran's collected revenue from the sales of oil, natural gas, and petrochemical products has increased by 150% in the current Iranian year, which ends March 20th. He cites a new greater marketing efforts and various contracting techniques as reason for the boost in Iran's revenues. OG denies speculations that the U.S. has lessened its pressure to curb Iran's oil revenues amid efforts to revive the JCPOA. He says the U.S. has in fact greatly increased its efforts to hamper Iranian oil exports in recent months. The Iranian minister says the U.S. campaign is no longer limited to punitive measures against Iran's clients. Washington has repeatedly moved to seize Iranian oil shipments. OG's comments follow Western media reports that the U.S. seized a cargo of two tankers carrying Iranian crude a while back. Now, the issue of human rights has always been a major concern in the international community, with some countries blaming others for not implementing their obligations. Iran says it has always been against double standards when it comes to human rights issues.
And the second issue that we are following it up at the level of international organizations dealing with the human rights is the issue of avoiding double standard and selective approaches. Human rights is human rights. And if it is violated, it is bad everywhere. Either it is in Iran or it is in other countries. We do not have bad or good violation of human rights. But what we are witnessing is a political approach toward the human rights.
Ghadi Babadi made the comments in an exclusive interview. He said some countries use human rights as a political tool against others to achieve their goals. The Iranian official added there are countries that have not held even one single election in their political lifetime but are still immune from criticism in international organizations. Ghadi Babadi reminded the fact that Tehran is a permanent member of several important international human rights treaties and is implementing its obligations under those accords. An exhibition is open in the Yemeni capital Sana'a to introduce part of crimes and violations committed by the Saudi-led coalition during 7 years of its war and siege. exhibitions were organized by students at Sana'a University. Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports.
To remind the world of years of bloodshed and destruction by a Saudi-led coalition in Yemen, Sana'a University has hosted an exhibition displaying drawings and photos of the war with subtitles in different languages, including Persian. During the inauguration ceremony, organizers praised the role of resistance media outlets in supporting the Yemeni people and exposing the crimes being committed against civilians by the Saudi-led coalition.
We really thank press for coming today. They're debating really a good thing. They're representing us in the Western countries, to the European countries, and also we just come to reality that we really besieged through military stuff. Through media.
Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed and millions of others have been suffering from the Saudi-led war and siege since 2015. Unfortunately, the mainstream Western media keep turning a blind eye to the crimes and violations against Yemenis. Despite the wounds inflicted by years of the Saudi-led war, this exhibition proves that art and creativity are still alive in Yemen. Organizers say the exhibition gives a clear idea of suffering millions of Yemenis have endured. It is also an attempt to revive the conscience of the world, which has seemingly died along with hundreds of thousands of innocent Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
New research reveals lost rainforest resiliency imperils biodiversity, carbon storage, and the climate at a global scale. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading Study Warns of Profound Consequences as Amazon Nears Tipping Point. Here's the story. The ability of the Amazon rainforest to recover from devastating droughts and wildfires has been declining over the past two decades, driving the crucial ecosystem to what authors of a study published recently called a critical transformation with profound consequences. The research published in the journal Nature Climate Change revealed that the world's largest rainforest has been losing resilience since the early 2000s, risking dieback, with profound implications for biodiversity, carbon storage, and climate change at a global scale as rainforests irreversibly transforms to savanna. Satellite imagery analyzed by the study's researchers revealed that over three-quarters of the Amazon is losing resilience. Chris Bolton, a climate scientist at the University of Exeter and co-author of the report, told Inside Climate News that resilience is defined as the ability of the Amazon rainforest to restore itself back to a stable state.
Thank you.
According to the site, the study adds to a mounting pile of research projecting that the Amazon will reach a point when it rapidly converts into a different, drier ecosystem, although the timing of this tipping point remains uncertain and whether it will encompass the entire rainforest is also debated. The authors of the new study have said the change could come within decades. They were reluctant to be more specific, but said the tipping point could be sooner even than current model suggests. The core idea is if the system is heading toward a tipping point where by definition it's getting less stable, this means that before that happens, it gets slower recovering from all these perturbations, like the drought events that are happening year to year, said Tim Lenton, another University of Exeter climate scientist and study co-author. If it gets to that tipping point and we commit to losing the Amazon rainforest, then we get significant feedback to global climate change, he continued. We'd lose about 90 billion tons of carbon dioxide, mostly from the trees and some from the soil, and that's several years of emissions. Lenton added that such a development would have knock-on effects elsewhere in the world. The new study notes that deforestation and climate change via increasing dry season length and drought frequency may already have pushed the Amazon close to a critical threshold of rainforest dieback. Other factors, including rising atmospheric temperatures in response to anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions, may additionally have negative effects on Amazon resilience, the publications added. According to The Guardian, areas closer to human destruction of the forest also became more unstable. Trees are crucial in producing rain, so failing them to clear land for beef and soy production creates a vicious circle of drier conditions and more tree loss. The good news, say researchers, is that the Amazon's tipping point has not yet been reached. Lenton said, so there is hope, who added that the new study's findings should encourage efforts to reverse deforestation and degradation of the Amazon to give it back some resilience against ongoing climate change. Under right-wing Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, the self-proclaimed Captain Chainsaw, deforestation in the country containing approximately 60% of the Amazon rainforest has reached its highest levels in more than a decade. The Brazilian Amazon ecosystem, as well as the nearly million indigenous people from over 300 tribes who live there, are under increasing threat from development, including logging, mining, expansion of agricultural activity, and the construction of a major highway and dam. While the crisis is most pronounced in Brazil, it is also occurring in other Amazon nations and territories, including Peru, Colombia, Ecuador, Venezuela, Suriname, and French Guinea. Chris Jones, a climate researcher at the Met Office Hadley Center in Britain, who was not involved in the new study, told The Guardian that this research adds compelling evidence that climate change is a risk now and that these severe and irreversible impacts could become a reality. We have a narrow window of opportunity to take urgent action, he stressed.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone, and let us listen to an aphorism from the Messenger of Mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, on how to protect the health of society. All my people will be virtuous if two classes of them become virtuous, and will be reprobate if these two classes become reprobate. They are the jurists and the leaders.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the importance of having a quality food. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the importance of the use of the quality food. When we talk about the quality food, definitely we talk about the healthy food, which is being said in the Quran and in the teachings of Islam. In today's world, we can see that our kids and our own selves, obviously, because we do not have enough time, we go to work, sometimes like we have kids going to the college, to the school, maybe we are working at the same time. Because of the shortage of time, we many times use junk food. We just buy a sandwich, we just buy a chips and burger, for example, and the other types of the fast food, which is like pizza and all other things that we can see in today's world that we are used to, and we get used to in eating these things. And other than this, if we want to have food, unfortunately, most of us do not know how to make a good food, a healthy food, and therefore we are not ready to spend some time for ourselves in order to make a good food. Whereas it is important, according to the Islamic teachings, that you should know that what you eat has impact on you. It has effect on you. Therefore, when I'm looking for myself, when I'm looking into a mirror, and for example, making my dress right, combing my hairs, similarly, when I want to eat something, I should look at my plate. What am I eating? I should look at my dinner table. What is ready for me to eat? Is it healthy or not? Because Islam gives importance to this. Islam says if you want to have an Islamic lifestyle, it is necessary to have a quality food. It is necessary to have a healthy food, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the importance of the use of a quality food. We said that unfortunately in today's world we can see like people are using junk food. They do not have time to cook food at home. And on top of that, they do not know what to cook and what to make for themselves. And therefore, that's why we can see that when such a pandemic like Corona or COVID, when it attacks the whole world, there are many people, unfortunately, who lose their life in this pandemic. And why is this happening? It is happening because the people do not have the healthy food. They do not have a quality food. They're eating junk food. They're eating the food which is not healthy. And we can also see that our generation is weaker than the previous generations, those who had pure food in their time, those who were eating the quality food, those who were not eating anything. Today, the industry of food has become the biggest industry. Now, the food is being produced through the industry. It is not the people, it is not the nature that is producing the food. Rather, it is the industry. Therefore, we need to be taking care of ourselves and our generations if we want to have a healthy life, if we want to have a life without trouble. And in the Islamic lifestyle, if we want to reach the perfection, it is necessary to have a quality and healthy food according to the Islamic teachings. Islam talks about healthy food. Islam talks about the pure food. Islam gives importance to all these things. Why? Because the mankind is important. The mankind is what it eats. Therefore, if we want to have a peaceful and a perfect life, it is necessary to have a quality and healthy food, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Races, beauty contests, and a marvelous show. Here is everything you need to know about the first Qatar Camel Festival. Qatar kicked off its very first edition of the Camel Festival earlier this month at Lepsire, Doha. The festival features unique and high-value breeds for the public to enjoy. Camels from all around the region will also get to flaunt their posture to earn the title of the most beautiful camel or the highest value breed in the festival. But first, the whole lot should be judged.
Judging is based on the size of the camel's head, the length of the neck, and the beautiful appearance of the animal and its health status. Of course, judging is different for each group of camels. For example, in the case of camels that are black, the focus is on the size of the animal's head. But on camels that are white, the focus is on the beauty of the camel and the harmony of the body and the beauty of the animal. In addition, we have very experienced professional staff who will deal with the animal if it is artificially beautified.
To spike excitement and competitiveness in those who enjoy such shows, the country has allocated a whopping 47 million Qatari riyals for the lucky winners. The 45-day event will last until March 22nd and will include various competitions, including 115 local and international races.
In the streets of the Chadian capital city, an actor is bringing culture to impoverished neighborhoods by organizing readings of poetry and plays.
Culture should be accessible to all. If we want to have a wonderful world, a harmonious world, everyone should be focused on the same dimensions to be able to dream together. And without culture, we don't be able to initiate development. And to initiate this stage of development, we need to invite people to think together.
The actor does not have a fixed place to tell his stories. He performs in public spaces and says it is his way of giving everyone the opportunity to discover and explore creativity. Among the activities Bonaventure organizes, one can name drawing with children and conducting acting classes. He believes music and theater bring other disciplines together, creating an avenue for enriching human connections. Residents, especially the children of the impoverished neighborhood, say they always look forward to Bonaventure's arrival. A first-of-its-kind selfie museum in the Central American country of Guatemala is gaining lots of attention from excited enthusiasts. The selfie museum is located in Antigua, Guatemala, and is made up of 40 rooms or scenarios. Each room is a recreation of a colorful theme. Wallpaper, wings, greenery, neon signs, and other props are all present to spark the interest of visitors. One room includes a levitating bed, and another is equipped with a spaceship. Other rooms have familiar scenarios of presidential offices and comic book characters for visitors to take photographs in. Several artists participated in creating the art illustrations. A zoo in Peru's capital city, Lima, is celebrating a rare hatching of endangered baby crocodiles. The Huachipa Zoo showcased three females and one male to the public on the World Wildlife Day. The four crocodiles were born in incubators as part of the conservation efforts for the reptile. This species is an American crocodile, which is on the endangered list of animals in Peru. Zookeepers say the black market and threats on their habitat have seen the crocodile population dwindle. The zoo regularly receives animals that were rescued from trafficking. Among those traits are tortoises, macaws, and monkeys.
The 2022 World Cup is reaching a fever pitch as hundreds of people line up at a shopping center in Qatar to take a picture with a trophy. The famous Golden World Cup trophy was unveiled during a ceremony at a mall in Doha, where excited football fans waited for their turn to see it. They were also given the option to take a selfie or have their photo taken professionally. While the competition is still nearly a year away, FIFA says more than a million tickets were requested within the first 24 hours after sales opened. The highest demand came from fans from Qatar, followed by Argentina, Mexico, and the United States, among others. Bangladesh is reviving the ancient tradition of producing a historically renowned fine hand-woven fabric called muslin. With the help of the government, the trade is making a comeback. Now, a workshop has been set up in Dhaka where weavers are being trained in the ancient art. They say it took them months to master the craft, working with incredibly fine hand-spun cotton yarns. The weavers say it takes them 8 hours to spin just 4 centimeters. Some varieties of the fabric are so fine that an entire muslin sari could fit inside a single matchbox.
There was a myth about muslin that it was so delicate that it would pass through even a small ring. Look, it's true. There is space to squeeze in another piece of cloth through this ring as well.
Breathing life back into this ancient trade was not easy. Officials with a revival project say there was little knowledge about how this fabric was made. Plus, the rare cotton variant, which makes this fabric so expensive, was also lost. The precious fabric was the most extravagant of its era and popular in Mughal courts. It was also imported into Europe for much of the 17th century and transformed the style of the aristocracy there.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
An art gallery in London, Tate Modern, is hosting an exhibition with a remarkable span of surrealist works. The exhibition, dubbed Surrealism Beyond Borders, features more than 170 artworks ranging from paintings and sculptures to photography and films. Works by more than 150 artists from over 60 years are on the display. The exhibit also has a wide geographical span and includes surrealist artworks from different countries. Some of the most prominent artists whose works are being exhibited include Pablo Picasso, Salvador Dali, and Ted Jones. The exhibition will run until August 9th. Impressive, creative, wonderful. That's how visitors describe the works of Vincent Hoogh, a Dutch post-impressionist painter being displayed in an impressive art exhibition in the Argentine capital. Hundreds of Van Hoogh's paintings are projected onto the walls of the gallery. The image bloom and ripple in front of the audience, creating a 3D-like and immersive experience. Van Gogh was one of the most famous and influential figures in Western art history of the 19th century. He is largely remembered for his impressionist style, a break from the old traditional art technique. He is also famous for his turbulent life, which was made for outlandish, emotionally charged paintings.
Persian language takes center stage in a conference in Tehran dubbed Promotion of Persian Language on Global Scale. The event seeks to preserve the ancient language through teaching it to non-Iranians. Yusuf Jalali has more.
Iran Imruz.
Persian language has been spoken for 3 millennia, but like every cultural heritage, it needs to be preserved. This is according to officials from Iran's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, who sat with Persian language activists to discuss ways to promote Persian through teaching it to non-Iranians.
Today is actually the Persian language day for me and for many of my colleagues. So if you allow me, I would like to continue in Farsi.
Thank you for this opportunity. The identity of a nation is a set of shared beliefs, shared culture and history, and all of these issues are reflected in the language that each nation speaks. So today, all of those who have a role in the promotion of Persian language gathered to exchange views on the preservation of Persian, and we at the Foreign Ministry will facilitate any effort made in this regard.
1,000 years ago, Iran had a poet named Ferdowsi whose poems are still popular and understood by our generation. This is significant and shows that Persian is an old language that has stayed intact through the centuries.
Sa'di Foundation is the leading entity in the promotion of Persian language. Every year, the Institute, together with the Islamic Culture and Relations Organization, holds a number of Persian refresher courses in and outside Iran for non-Persian speakers. Recently, the Institute has launched online courses and published self-study books for Persian language enthusiasts.
By launching the online Persian training platforms, we saw a sudden increase in the number of applicants from different countries. This is because many of those who are interested in learning Persian gained an instant access to Persian teaching contents. At the same time, we continue to launch in-person courses organized by Iran's cultural attaches and hosted by Iranian overseas schools.
Persian comes from the Indo-European family of languages. The earliest versions of Persian date back to roughly 2,500 years ago, during the Achaemenid dynasty. Today, it is spoken by more than 300 million people in the world, and different dialects, including Dari and Pashto, in countries such as Iran, Afghanistan, and Tajikistan. Besides its significant impact on science, medicine, and astronomy, Persian has its own prominent place in literature and poetry. Khayyam, Rumi, Sa'di and Hafez are only a few examples of world-renowned Persian poets.
Language is the identity of a nation, and through the centuries of its spoken and written history, Persian has grown to become the narrator of Iran's rich past and its ancient civilization. Now, as learning a language is learning a culture, experts here say promoting Persian on a global scale is translated into introducing Iran and its culture to the world. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Students and staff gather for sizzling meat sandwiches as they signal their orders with their hands at a food truck in Pakistan's capital city of Islamabad. The Abbey Cow is no ordinary food truck parked on the campus of the Millennium Universal College. It's fully managed and run by staff with hearing impairments. At the beginning of the queue, a diagram shows simple phrases in sign language which customers use to order their food and communicate. The food truck is Pakistan's first mobile restaurant entirely staffed by deaf workers, providing an economic opportunity for them.
Having the startup here at our campus has been really fruitful. Not only have we created more awareness around the sign language amongst our students, but we've also created an inspiration for TMUC students to look up and pursue entrepreneurship as a career choice.
The project developer, Aisha Raza, says the majority of deaf youth end up unemployed and face inequality and discrimination. She says she wanted to create an opportunity for her brothers to economically thrive. The goal is to bridge communication gaps between the deaf and hearing communities and help remove language barriers. The food truck is the brainchild of a family where both parents and their sons are either totally or partially deaf.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Rights advocates have recently accused U.S. lawmakers of hypocrisy for backing severe sanctions to punish Russian aggression in Ukraine while unconditionally supporting the Zionist regime and condemning efforts to hold it accountable for violating international law in Palestine. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading U.S. Lawmakers Slammed for Double Standard on Russia and the Zionist Regime Crimes Against Palestinians. Here's the story. Rights advocates have recently accused U.S. lawmakers of hypocrisy for backing severe sanctions to punish Russian aggression in Ukraine while unconditionally supporting the Zionist regime and condemning efforts to hold it accountable for violating international law in Palestine. Yusuf Munayer, a non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center in Washington, D.C., told Politico, "We are watching at this moment a really horrific set of violations of international law and human rights in Ukraine, and we are seeing an international response that is unified, robust, and also completely hypocritical." Munayer, who supports the Nonviolent Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement, BDS, for Palestinian rights, stressed that Russia should be held accountable for its invasion of Ukraine, while noting the disparate treatment by U.S. lawmakers of Palestinians and Ukrainians resisting aggression. Members of Congress have shown their hypocrisy on this issue by supporting anti-BDS legislation when it comes to demanding accountability for Israel's human rights violations, he said. But now they are all for these kinds of efforts targeting Russia. Before Russian troops even invaded Ukraine, lawmakers from both parties supported stringent sanctions in response to what Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chair Bob Menendez called Russia's brazen violation of international law for declaring Moscow-backed enclaves in Donetsk and Luhansk independent. The Zionist regime's actions constitute flagrant violations of international law, according to prominent international organizations and human rights groups. The nearly 55-year occupation of the West Bank and East Al-Quds, and construction and expansion of exclusively Jewish settlements on occupied Palestinian land, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinian communities, the blockade of Gaza, the killing and a wounding of civilians during military operations, ranging from wars to protest suppression, and other policies and actions, including what prominent Israeli regime and international rights groups call apartheid, all run afoul of international law. As the Biden administration, an overwhelming majority in both houses of Congress support severe sanctions targeting the Russian government and economy, they remain steadfast supporters of the fake regime of Israel, which receives $3.8 billion in unconditional annual U.S. aid, and vocal opponents of efforts to boycott the nation. In 2019, House members approved a resolution condemning BDS by a vote of 398-17. Recently, Representative Lee Zeldin reintroduced the Israel Anti-Boycott Act, which in a previous iteration threatened violations with up to $1 million in fines and as many as 20 years imprisonment. On the same day, he called for an immediate end to Russian oil imports. Politico fellow Joseph Gideon noted recently that while U.S. politicians have jumped over themselves to sanction Russia back to Stone Age, widespread anti-BDS sentiment among politicians has advocates iced out of public debate. Khaled El Gindi, a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, told Politico that the U.S. has sanctions against many countries that haven't invaded their neighbors. But whereas the international community mobilized swiftly to confront Russia's occupation of Ukraine, it has done very little to roll back Israel's occupation. It's exactly this lack of any real accountability or constraints on Israel that ultimately led to BDS movement, he added.
Shia Muslims in Nigeria. Nigeria, a country in West Africa near the equator. A country with the largest population in Africa. The population is near 200 million people. Even though Nigeria is the largest economy in Africa and the richest man in Africa is from this country, poverty is evident everywhere in the nation. The vast uranium, gold, iron resources, and oil reserves haven't reduced the pressure of poverty on the people and have failed to bring welfare and peace for them. Nigerian people have strong religious beliefs. On Sundays, the Christians form congregations of tens of thousands of people and go to churches. Muslims, who form the majority of the population in the country, learn about religious teachings from childhood. In Zaria, a city north of Nigeria, a Muslim teacher lives. Our story is about him.
My name is Zina Ibrahim, Zinatuddin Ibrahim, and I'm from the Islamic movement, and the wife of Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki. I was born in Zaria, Nigeria, the city of Zaria, and I did my primary school and secondary school in Zaria. And when I was in around 1978, when I was in the second to the last class of graduating from secondary school, that was when I started putting on hijab. You know, you feel as if you have committed a crime if you put on hijab, you know. And at that time, there was, nobody was putting on the hijab. Most people, they go almost naked with short dresses and so on. So it was very difficult, you know. When I'm putting hijab, but I feel as if I should cover myself away from people because they will be shouting as if I have committed a crime because I wear the hijab. So that was the situation in the university. But the way I was raised from home, we only felt that if you are praying and you are fasting during Ramadan, then you are a good Muslim, and that is all. You know, if you have money, you go to Hajj, and if you have money, you give zakat. If you do this, you are a complete Muslim. But we don't know that Islam is affects the whole of our life. But it is through the lectures that people like Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki used to give to us that we realize that Islam is a complete system of life.
Sheikh Ibrahim Zakzaki graduated in 1979 in economics. He was well aware of the atmosphere at universities, so he decided to do something for the Nigerian youth. He would go to different universities and deliver speeches for students about the concepts in Islam and the Quran. He held classes for interpretation of the Quran. He also established the Association of Muslim Youth with the students. Initially, it was an underground association with limited activities, but after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, its activities entered a whole new phase. Now, even the Nigerian newspapers were publishing news on the revolution in Iran.
When I was at school at 78, we started hearing something about the Islamic Revolution. And alhamdulillah, we all supported the Islamic Revolution. Because at first what we were hearing, we were hearing that there are some Muslims in Iran who are trying to establish Islam. And there is one big Ayatollah, and his name is Imam Khomeini. He's the one who is leading the revolution. So we were supporting the revolution. You know, I could remember at that time, during break time, they bring newspapers to our library. During break time, we quickly rush to the library to read the developments about the revolution, what we can read about it. So the victory that Allah gave to the Imam here, it encourages the Sheikh to see that what we are hoping to happen has happened here in Iran. So we can take the example of what happened here in Iran. It means it can happen again. Because at that time, people has lost hope all over the world. During the first anniversary of the Islamic Revolution, he was invited here. That was January, February 1980. So when he came to Iran, he saw the kind